You are listening to. First Gen Teachers Lens.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the First Gen Teacher Lens podcast. First of all, I want to announce, sorry for the delay of the episode. Recorded late, kind of had to make time arrangements, but we're back. And in this episode, I talk about teacher representation. What does that mean for the most neediest communities to have teachers that represent those communities, whether it be BIPOC, you know, different sexual orientations. Focus mainly on BIPOC on this episode, but my guest is Ms. Cleverly Beverly. Stay tuned. Peace.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcasts. Now let's get back to the episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the First Gen Teacher Lens podcast. On today's episode, we're going to talk about teacher representation, which is very important to me and my guest as well. Here she is to introduce herself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Anjali Beverly. I am a fourth grade teacher in California, soon to be expat teacher. I strongly believe in culturally responsive teaching, and I'm an advocate and coach for project-based learning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on board. I know, like, I've seen your Instagram. I've seen the way you represent, like, culturally responsive books in your classroom library, which is, like, man, that's kudos to you to build that, because I know that's tough with curriculum constraints. But one thing that led me to an idea, you know, talking about culturally responsive education, teacher representation needs to be done in a lot of, you know, I want to say across the board of education. And that makes me think about, like, the statistics. But before we get to that, what does teacher representation mean to you?
Well, when I think of the word representation at all, I know that representation means to speak on behalf of. And that's what, when we think of a representative, they're speaking on behalf of someone else. And so in the classroom, teachers serve as representatives of society, which means they are role models and they're reflective of society, which means they're diverse in ideas, diverse in how they look, diverse in the cultural capital that they're able to bring to the classroom. And so a representative, and especially a teacher representative, should be someone who can speak on behalf of society and can also bring their own cultural capital to support students and making connections with others.
As a poignant point that you made, it serves like bringing their cultural capital. I like that, where you're investing not only part of yourself, but also investing in the kids that may or may not have like similar cultures to you. Because I know, yes, for me, as a Latinx teacher, I know that I don't necessarily represent like kids that like are of African descent, but for them, they know that like my parents are immigrants as well. So that's something that's a commonality that I find at my school. I bond with those kids with, in terms of like talking about, you know, having parents that like, you know, came to you out of struggle learning the language. Mm-hmm. Having kind of a unique cultural name and like teachers mispronouncing it. Mm-hmm. And like me wanting to pronounce it correctly because it's your name, it's unique to you. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely a good point to make in terms of cultural capital, which segues into my next question. Do you have any fond memories of teachers who embodied this idea of teacher representation?
I did. So the main teacher that comes to mind is Miss White. She was my fifth grade teacher. And every single morning she would have us read, stand up, the whole class, and we had to recite a positive affirmation that we all said together in unison. And it set the tone for the entire day. I have never heard of teachers doing that back then. I got all the way to fifth grade, and no teacher had ever done that. And for her to look like me, to be a Black woman, to be so, she was so professional and so smart and so positive. And the way that she uplifted us, and we were all, our school was predominantly Black and Latinx, but we also had a really large Samoan, Tongan, Hmong, and Laotian population in my school. So we were all children of color, like every single, we were all children of color. And to have this woman who could connect with our experience meant a lot, knowing she came in knowing that we needed to be uplifted starting off the day. She also would play songs. We would take moments in the day where we would just dance to music that our families would probably listen to. Mm-hmm. And that got us motivated. It got us, it increased our engagement. So that would definitely be my main fond memory of a teacher who looked like me. And I'm so glad I had her in fifth grade. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of folks didn't get that till college, and I had her in fifth grade. So I'm so blessed and honored that I had Miss White.
Right. I kind of, messed up on the, you know, we're talking earlier about, like, you know, in terms of higher academia, where I did have a Latinx professor, but I remembered I did have a Latinx teacher. I just remembered her because my mom still has the report card. In PS55, I'll never forget, because I was labeled an ESL student because obviously in my household, we only spoke Spanish speaking. Mm-hmm. And I, like, the way that New York City worked, they were just like, they made me take this test, I remember. And then they were like, yeah, he's an ESL student.
Yes.
It was Miss Gonzalez. I remember because, like, my mom read me the report card. It was all in Spanish. Her penmanship is super nice, by the way.
You know,
I could see it. But I remember, like, being in PS55 and then having bilingual texts. And that's the first, I want to say, immersion to reading I've had. And then we had this one book. And I think Miss Gonzalez inspired my mom in a way to bring those bilingual texts in and, like, you know, flip back from English to Spanish. And we read this book that kind of flipped the notion of, like, a white fairy tale. Mm-hmm. It was Abuelo and the Three Bears, or Tres Ojos. I remember that book like yesterday because, like, it had words and language that was in there that I could identify with. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if I was on, like, we pass a McDonald's, I was like, Mom, can we go get McDonald's? And then she'd say, I frijoles, there's beans in the house. There's food. That's one thing that she repeat all the time, because it was true. There was always beans in the house. And then that was one of my fondest memories of, like, her pushing me, and not only pushing me, but also my mother, to, like, go to the library, find these texts that are, you know, representative of not only me, but other Latinx kids that have, like, similar linguistic language. So that would be my, like, fond memory.
Oh, man, big old props to Miss Gonzalez, because a lot of families that I work with think that they should be trying to only do English at home, even though they know that they're Spanish speaking. And I feel like there's so many studies that are showing that when a student has mastered Spanish at home, it helps them support their English. And when you put it together and you are having a student read in both languages, it really increases their comprehension. So big up to Ms. Gonzalez for supporting you, supporting your family, and being able to, like, see yourselves represented in text.
Yeah, Ms. Gonzalez, wherever you are, if you're still out there, like, kudos to you, Ms. Gonzalez. I'll never forget that, PS55.
She's before her time. She was before her time.
Yeah, she really was. And then moving on to the next question, it's kind of a two-part question, we can obviously break it down. Okay. So my first question is, why does representation matter to BIPOC teachers and their students? And then why should teacher representation matter to all teachers, including teachers that aren't BIPOC and kind of fit the mold of their population?
Okay, great. Those are two, yeah, you're right. They are two-part questions. So representation matters to, I don't know if children can articulate that it matters to them, but you can see a shift in learning. You can see a shift in engagement when a student has a teacher that not only looks like them, but at least takes the time to ensure that that person, their identity is represented in curriculum. And the reason why I say that, it matters because children, I believe they should, and I actually think they must see themselves represented in the school community, not just in teachers, but in all the stakeholders. So that means they should see themselves represented in the leaders, the teachers, and especially the counselors. I have to say that again, especially the counselors. The counselors are the ones who are, you know, offering the guidance, who are listening and giving support. And sometimes counselors, if they don't understand the way the community operates that they're that the student is from, they may not even be able to support or offer the same support. Mm-hmm. Or they might hear something that might ring off as, ooh, that doesn't sound like that should happen. And the next thing you know, not to completely get off a tangent, but there have been many cases in which counselors from different backgrounds don't understand the background of the child. Mm-hmm. And CPS is called because they didn't mm-hmm. understand the parenting style. Mm-hmm. That is a prime example of what happens when we don't understand each other's communities, when we don't understand each other's culture. Mm-hmm. And so cultural capital is a very real. Cultural capital, we understand that capital, you know, we look at that as money. Mm-hmm. Cultural capital is when our culture can translate into, I don't want to say currency, but it's an exchange. It's an exchange of being able to make connections based on, oh, so in El Salvador, you eat casamiento? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, in Nicaragua, we eat gallo pinto. And yeah. then you have this, and oh, and then in Ghana, you know what? We call gallo pinto and casamiento, we call that red. It's right. all when you're able to take the cultures and build upon it and build connections. And that's where relationships form. When you're able to make connections, relationships form. We're able to make connections. That is the catalyst to learning. The way our brain works, it is based on neurons. And when you have a neuron, there's little dendrites that come out from these neurons every time a new connection is made. So right. a student is learning about, you know, how to add, and then you add the commutative property on that, that's a dendrite that's going to help make that connection. The same thing happens with cultural capital. When students are able to see teachers that look like them, and mm-hmm. the teachers may be able to maybe make a word problem, a math word problem with the student's name from their community, it's going to help them like listen better. Oh, did you say Jerome? Oh my God. Did you say Emiliano? Like, okay, I have a cousin named Emiliano. I'm going to listen to the word problem more.
Right.
When students are able to, or when we're, instead of comparing students who are, how many miles did he go hang gliding or something? Hang gliding? We don't do hang gliding. You think of things that children are actually doing in their community, in their culture, and you weave that into the classroom, and connections are made, the catalyst to learning. Relationships are built, and right. connections can also create changed behaviors. So that is why I think it matters so much to children. And I think educators understand that piece as well. And that's why it matters so much to BIPOC educators. So I'll pause there.
No, it's true. It's true. Like my kids love TikTok. And I recently got discovered by them. I mean, it's fine, but they were laughing at my name because like in New York, I don't know. It's like, I guess this slang that I've like always heard when like people yell, they say you're, and then my name is Mr. C is your teacher. Uh-huh. They're laughing. They're like, Mr. C, how do you know about that? I was like, bro, we're all from New York. Like we live yes. in like the same borough. Like, uh-huh. like you guys don't think I don't know the lingo, and they're all laughing. So those interpersonal connections that you make where you yeah. add a student's name, like you were saying, or a situation, maybe a familiar place, right? For yeah. example, when I do my my autobiography, right? I sometimes add, like, I was running in the park near the school, Roy Wilkins, and the kids like, oh, like they like chuckle here and there. And that does add like kind of a connectivity that yeah. is deeper than like, you know, these pre-cookie cookie cutter curriculums that are made, that teachers should be, you know, embodying their community within the curriculum, because oftentimes these preset curriculums are made by somebody out of the state that doesn't know the immediate community.
Mm-hmm. And they're very distant. They're not really clear on what will make students engaged. And when students hear the parts of their neighborhood being represented, when they hear names that they know, when they hear activities that they do, it increases engagement. And the engagement is that piece where you can pull them in for the learning part. And that's why culturally responsive teaching is so important. And it's responsive because you're responding to the needs of the students in your classroom. And you're responding to all of their needs. And that means you're representing every single culture that you're seeing in that classroom through mentioning activities that they may do, through mentioning certain words. When I'm launching a new lesson and I have new vocabulary, because my students are predominantly Spanish speaking, mostly from Central America and Mexico, I will ask them, okay, well, I might ask them to tell us, how do we say this word in Spanish? And then they get to stand up, say it in Spanish. And then now they're even more engaged because their funds of knowledge and their cultural capital got validated in the classroom. It's so important to keep that piece in there. And there's often times where I'll just have the word already in there and they're able to make that connection, which is what we call oftentimes words from different languages and they connect.
I'm blanking on it too.
It's not conjugates, is it? Okay, you can go to the next question while I figure out.
Sure. What it is. No, the next question is the
other. Why it should matter
to all teachers.
I have to look this up because.
No, it's okay.
I've been out of the classroom for y'all only 3 weeks, so I should know. I feel like it is conjugates, but now I've been, it's conjugates.
Yeah.
It is conjugates, which works really great in a dual classroom. I'm a dual teacher, so forgive me for blanking on
that. No, it's okay. So you're right anyway. Like, I was just like, I'm pretty sure that's right.
So why representation should matter to all teachers, BIPOC or not? Same thing. As you mentioned, my culturally responsive library represents every single person, not just the people in my classroom, It represents everyone. I believe that we as educators should be opening a door for students to make connections with all people, because that's how we learn from each other. And if we do not make space for students to learn about other cultures, and for students to learn from each other, it can create a world of not so good. It can create some xenophobia there.
Right.
If we don't open that door, open that space up. And so by allowing students to speak for themselves, by allowing students to represent their culture, by bringing in community members, by bringing in family members, these are some of the things that teachers who are not BIPOC could do. Mm-hmm. They can ask students to share if they want, right? If they want, if you would like to share, but never putting anybody on the spot. You never want, oh my God, I'll never forget my teacher, Mr. DeLuca, in high school when we were reading Huckleberry Finn.
Ooh.
He wanted me, the only Black person in the class, to read the slave part. Not okay.
Right.
That's an example of what you don't do. You don't automatically assume that because someone is of a certain background, ethnic background, that they should be the speaker. You have to make sure it's a question. Bring it up to parents. Hey, if anyone would like to bring in some different cultural dishes, if anyone would like to come share how to make a certain thing, please, you're welcome. Making it open for every single person. It is important to do that. One, it helps to build trust within your school, your classroom community. Your students will know that they are valued by you. Your students will feel validated. The parents will feel validated. When you have built trust, when you have made their culture valid and made their experience valid, students will learn from you with more ease because they can trust you. So this is why it is so important for even non-BIPOC educators to be representative or to make sure that cultural representation is happening in their classroom, because you want to ensure that students are comfortable learning from each other, comfortable learning from other people who do not look like them. Mm-hmm. And you want to make sure you are building a community of trust in your classroom so that learning can happen.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. You want the it should matter to all teachers, because you want to be, as a teacher, automatically as your role, you should be an advocate for all your students, right? You should be placing, you know, those ideas that even though they're not a part of your culture, the student connectivity and the validity of it will be more impactful than just, you know, saying, oh, I'm just going to teach the lesson how it is. Like, adding those little nuances to your lesson helps in bountiful ways. That's what I know from, like, you know, adding those ideas and like switching up the lesson. Like, my coworker and I switch our lesson up all the time just to add like maybe a little do now that kind of like gets the lesson started.
Yeah.
And then like kids are already engaged and they're already hooked in, mm-hmm. into whatever, you know, activity that we're doing. And then my last question is kind of a doozy. How do we get schools and especially universities to get more BIPOC teachers in the field? I know there are different initiatives. For example, in New York City, we have NYC Men Teach, but still, as we know, the statistic is abysmal for a lot of Latinx and Black teachers, that the field is limited in terms of representation and you know, those pockets of field, as well as all their cultures as well.
You know, from the university level, I'm not as well versed,
mm-hmm.
to answer that at the university level. As a fourth grade teacher, I've been in education for 12 years. I taught 2 years high school, and you know, the other 10 have been in elementary. So I'm not familiar with what the process is or what could be done for universities. I do know the school that I went to was the first school to ever have an ethnic studies department, SF State. So San Francisco State University is the first school to ever have an ethnic studies department. We had we had Angela Davis on our campus. We've had Danny Glover on our campus fighting for, Oakland is the home of the Black Panther Party. So where I live is very much a space of fighting for rights and fighting for the voice of BIPOC people to be heard in the classrooms, because it is so needed that people understand the truth, that people are being taught the absolute truth. No sugarcoating, no what history books only want to tell the piece, mm-hmm. bits and pieces of, but the full story. So for the university perspective, I'm not exactly sure what needs to be done. I could tell you what I think could be done from an elementary high school perspective. And I think the first step is all stakeholders need to request it. And what I mean by stakeholders, I mean the teachers need to be requesting it. The parents should be requesting it. And if the leaders are in alignment, they also should be requesting it. Who do they request it from? You go to your board of education. You write to your board of education. You write letters. They, I'm very familiar with how boards work. They always have a public comment at the beginning, and they also have times where you can put a request in writing. And when you put that in writing, it is forever in writing, and they have to act on it. So you would have to mobilize the stakeholders in the community, in the school community, asking for what it is that they want, and the board must respond because the board works for you all. So that would be my number one thing. You also could join the board. Teachers, there's always a teacher on a school board, but there must always be a parent on the school board. So you can join the board. If you're not on that board, like I said, you can go right to the board, make friends with people on the board, so that one day you possibly can get in to the board, because you know, it's often very like someone bringing someone in, hey, like I think this person will be a great person, and then they get nominated in or voted in. But I would say really leaning on your board and really making sure you have mobilized around what it is you need. If the board's not listening, you can still work together, have meetings with your teachers. Like, this is what needs to happen. This is what our students need. And we need to make sure we are recruiting we need recruiting of teachers who look like our students. We even need leadership and counselors that look like our students. We need to do this. Can you go talk to your friends? Can you go talk to your friends and invite them? Can we start posting on our social media like people like to do? Hey, we have job offerings. We have job openings. Mm-hmm. There's tons of hiring fairs.
Right.
Tons of hiring fairs. Volunteer. Teachers and parents and leaders can volunteer to not only go to hiring fairs, but be on the hiring committee. I am always on the hiring committee. Mm-hmm. When you're on the hiring committee, you have a say-so on who works at your school. So those are my main things on how we can increase BIPOC representation, but not just increase representation, because the reality is there's 85% of teachers are white women, but mm-hmm. also educating folks on why it's so important to have representation in the classroom, right. whether you are BIPOC or not. And that comes from having quality PDs, asking leaders to bring in certain folks to teach about implicit bias, having leaders come in to teach about culturally responsive teaching, having leaders to come in to teach about how to alter and edit your classroom library and curriculum. There are so many things that could be done. So I don't know
no.
If that answered your question, but those are the things I think that could help.
No, that definitely answered my question, where, you know, you are being an advocate, again, like that word for like, you know, getting people, like, for example, I like your idea in terms of, like, you know, getting, being on the hiring committee, because for my school, like, there are certain teachers where I was just like, if I was on this committee, I would have never onboarded them, because yeah. there was such a disconnect with the students, yeah. and then later they just leave and find a better position, then that leaves a gap.
They consider better.
right, exactly. And then that leaves a gap for the most vulnerable. Like, the most vulnerable are kids that are BIPOC, and especially in New York City, it's very segregated, where redlining, property values, mm-hmm. from New York City down to Long Island, even, like, determine the quality of your education. And I think if people, you know, have teachers, or communities have teachers that are, you know, from the communities or similar communities, and like represent the culture, mm-hmm. that could really make and turn around schools where, you know, you had maybe a school district that wasn't doing well, like my hometown is not the best school district. Mm-hmm. In 2002, historically, we were the first school district to be taken over by the state. Yeah. And now I see the remnants of teachers who stayed there, who aren't a part of the culture, mm-hmm. but are invested in the community, because
yes.
and that is a testament to staying there and, you know, teaching these kids that they know are the most needy in terms of, like, resources, advocacy, representation. Yeah. So I think you're right on the money in terms of, like, be a part of that hiring process, join the Board of Ed, and be a kind of like a megaphone and sound the alarm for getting more teachers that are for the community,
yes.
and beyond, to kind of, again, advocate for those kids.
Yes. Definitely.
And before we go, just so people can know where to find you on, like, social media.
You can find me on Instagram at miss.cleverly.beverly. You also can find me on my website at misscleverlybeverly.com. And when you get to the website, you'll see the YouTube, you'll see the Pinterest, you'll see the TPT store. But please feel free to reach out, and I'm just grateful that you all were here to listen, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming up on board on the First Gen Teacher Lives podcast, and I'll see you next time.
Yes, you will. Thank you.
Thank you for having listened to the First Gen Teacher's Lives. We'll see you here next time.